Hamas says Israeli crimes will not affect Palestinians' will to fight. This after regime forces killed three young Palestinians in a raid in the occupied West Bank. Iran dismisses as unfounded allegations by the Group of Seven wealthy nations regarding its peaceful nuclear program. And the U.S. signs a pact that gives it access to Papua New Guinea's airfields and ports, competing with China's growing footprint in the Pacific region. Welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned in to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to the West Bank city of Nablus, where Palestinians hold yet another funeral procession, this time for three young men killed by Israeli forces, shot dead in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The young Palestinians were shot during a raid on the Balata camp east of Nablus. Public mourning has been declared in the city for the three men. Israeli forces also injured at least 65 Palestinians, three of them critically. The Hamas resistance movement now says Israeli crimes will not affect Palestinians' will to fight the regime and to support the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The movement says Palestinian sanctities are red lines that Israel should not cross. The regime has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians since the formation of a new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu late last year. Now, this year alone, so far, Israeli forces have killed over 140 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Well, a barrage of condemnations coming in after a far-right Israeli minister visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in a violation of the holy site's status quo. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman denounced the move, calling it a provocative step by an extremist member of the Israeli apartheid regime. Nasser Kanani called for urgent measures by the international community to prevent such crimes. Earlier, the Arab League slammed the move as a dangerous escalation, warning of an uncontrollable religious conflict. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also slammed the visit as barbaric, a barbaric incursion. Well, the United States also weighed in. Washington called the visit provocative, saying the holy site should not be used for political purposes. Sunday's visit by Cabinet Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir was his second since he took office. He also claimed Israel owns the compound. Palestinians push back against the comments, saying such rhetoric does not change the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Well, Iran has slammed the statement by the Group of Seven countries after it accused Tehran of escalating its nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry rejected the allegation as baseless. Spokesman Nasser Kanani said Iran's nuclear program has been peaceful and nuclear weapons have no place in its security doctrine. Kanani also slammed the G7 for its paradoxical policies toward other countries. It was a reference to the G7's call for abidance by a UN resolution. The U.S. is breaching by imposing anti-Iran sanctions. The spokesman also slammed the group for accusing Iran of destabilizing West Asia. He said G7 members are the main source of regional destabilization. Kanani also once again rejected providing drones to Russia for its war in Ukraine. He reiterated the need for a political solution there. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has appointed Brigadier General Ali Akbar Ahmadiyan as the new secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. Ahmadiyan, 62, has been the head of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps Strategic Center. He's also served as the commander of the forces navy and is now a member of the Expediency Council. He is replacing Ali Shamkhani, who served in the powerful security position for 10 years. The Iranian Navy's 86th Fleet has returned home following an eight-month voyage around the globe. Addressing a ceremony to welcome the arrival of the naval fleet, top Iranian General Mohammad Baghari called the expedition a landmark accomplishment in the history of the country's naval missions.
Oh. Mission accomplished. Iranian Navy's 86th flotilla has wrapped up its 8-month voyage and returned home. The flotilla, comprised of domestically manufactured Dena destroyer and Macron forward base ship, arrived at the southern port city of Bandar Abbas on Saturday. The naval fleet set sail on a mission around the world from Bandar Abbas in September 2022. The flotilla stopped at the port of Mumbai, India, and then docked in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after passing through the Bay of Bengal and the Strait of Malacca. The fleet continued its journey towards the Java Sea and passed through the Strait of Makassar, arriving in the vast Pacific Ocean for the first time in the history of Iran's military seafaring. Crossing the Pacific Ocean, the fleet moved toward the Strait of Magellan in the south of the Americas and entered the South Atlantic Ocean. The naval squadron also passed the coasts of Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and finally anchoring in the port of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. The flotilla then crossed the Atlantic Ocean and anchored in the city of Cape Town, South Africa. It then berthed in the coasts of Oman and finally sailed into the Iranian territorial waters. An official ceremony was held in Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of the naval fleet. Addressing the official homecoming ceremony of the flotilla, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces said the arrival of the 86th Naval Flotilla is a source of pride for the Iranian nation and a landmark accomplishment in the history of the country's naval missions. Major General Mohammad Hossein Bagheri said the flotilla concluded its historic voyage on the high seas to mark what he called an outstanding achievement despite Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic. General Bagheri said maritime prowess is among the most important factors of Iran's military might. He added, "We do not lack anything to achieve such an ideal and are gifted with homegrown industries for that purpose." He noted that the Iranian courageous commanders and marines undertake naval missions valiantly and fearlessly.
Well, the arrival of the Iranian Navy's 86th fleet shines a spotlight on the maritime prowess of the Islamic Republic. The Navy has been maintaining regional and international peace and enhancing international economic stability by protecting shipping routes. Well, Iran is also determined to boost its defense capabilities in the face of threats.
The arrival of the naval fleet to Bandar Abbas comes as the unprecedented move of the Iranian Navy in carrying out such difficult missions ushers in a new era for the Iranian armed forces. As Major General Bagheri put it, the 86th flotilla of the Navy fulfilled a historic mission. Even major countries in the world do not have the courage to undertake such a task. What makes the round-the-world mission significant, though, is the way Western countries, namely the United States, reacted to it. In February, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the two ships while they were on the international voyage. According to Iranian officials, the U.S. has also failed to prevent the Iranian naval flotilla from sailing through the Panama Canal, an 82-kilometer waterway in Panama that connects the Atlantic Pacific Oceans. Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, has said, quote, "The global arrogance tried to block the Iranian flotilla's mission through threats and sanctions, but the successful voyage marked another slap in their faces." The Navy commander also said that France claimed that Iranian ships had entered its waters, but they changed course when they were reminded of their own shipping rules and regulations. All those reactions highlight Iran's naval prowess in international waters. In recent years, naval forces of the Islamic Republic have enhanced their presence throughout global waters to protect shipping routes and provide security for merchant vessels and tankers. The Iranian Navy has also regularly carried out patrols in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean to fight piracy in an effort to secure vessels commuting in international waters. Not to mention that numerous attacks on Iranian or foreign vessels have been thwarted by the Iranian Navy in recent years. All in all, the unprecedented voyage by the 86th flotilla not only has shown Iran's maritime capabilities, but drove home the point that the language of threat and force does not work with Iran, as it is committed to asserting its strength in international waters and providing security to its vessels.
Now, the United States has signed a security agreement with Papua New Guinea. As rivalry between Washington and Beijing is growing in the Pacific region, under the deal, American forces are given access to Papua New Guinea's airfields and ports. In return, the allied nation will gain access to the U.S. satellite surveillance. U.S. State Department says the pact will enhance bilateral cooperation and will increase stability in the Pacific. The deal has sparked several protests in the island country over the impact on ties with key trade partner China. The U.S. has been expanding its presence in the Pacific as part of a strategic shift to East Asia, where it seeks to contain the growing power of China. Beijing also signed a security pact with the Solomon Islands in 2022. Well, political analyst Angelo Giuliano is of the opinion that by signing a security agreement with Papua New Guinea, the U.S. wants to show that China that it has a foothold in the region.
I think there's a very little significance just because Papua New Guinea is quite far from China. What the U.S. needs in the region is to have a power projection and to be able to station military troops very close to China. And this is going to be fulfilled by mainly South Korea and Japan and also the Philippines. So this is, I think it's more like symbolic. It's, the U.S. is showing China that it has a foothold there in the region. And it's to counterbalance the deal that the China did with Solomon Island. Just to put into perspective, the U.S. is talking about cooperation with Papua New Guinea. When you look at what Papua New Guinea exports, only 1% goes to the U.S., even less. With China, it's a major partner with China. It's over 20% of its exports that are going to China. And you need to also to put into perspective that the question is, Papua New Guinea, does it have a choice to say no to Washington? If it says no to Washington, there's a risk of a colored revolution because there's a lot of money that has been poured into Papua New Guinea over decades through the National Endowment for Democracy and through USAID.
Well, the EU's refugee policy goes under the spotlight again in the European Parliament, being branded as illegal under international law and discriminatory. Refugees in Belgium claim those seeking asylum from Ukraine are receiving preferential treatment. Jerome Hughes brings us more from Brussels.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there were hundreds of refugees, mainly from African and Middle Eastern countries, sleeping on the streets outside the main asylum application centre in Brussels. Authorities have since cleared the area. The refugees have fled to neighbouring countries or have been crammed into emergency accommodation. A few remain in the area, but say their situation would be different if they came from Ukraine.
Only because we are Afghan, because we come from Syria, because we don't have the same color, because we don't have same culture, but it will be not the reason. Of course, a lot of people, we have the same mind. I can work, I can do everything.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that EU nations are erecting borders on land and strengthening aggressive coast guard services at sea. The bloc pays billions of euro to outside countries to stop refugees from attempting to travel here, unless they are from Ukraine.
The EU slogan is break the business model of smugglers. But what we do is feeding them by blocking all pathways to protection.
There is a heavy far-right anti-refugee presence in the Parliament.
Europe needs a policy based on strong border control.
But many legislators are calling for a more civilized approach.
We already fund third countries like Libya, actually militias over there, to build camps, to host people there. And we see murder, we see rape, and we do not see a humane solution.
Key EU figures are currently in Hiroshima, Japan, for a G7 meeting. 350,000 people were living there when their closest ally, the United States, dropped its catastrophic atomic bomb in 1945. More support for Ukraine is high on the agenda. Critics say the last thing on their minds is providing refuge to those fleeing countries they helped destabilize in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, concerns are on the rise in Afghanistan over the high level of poverty with children withstanding the worst of its consequences. As Abdullah Amirzadeh reports from Kabul, many children are working to take a morsel home while facing malnutrition and exclusion from school.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasem, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to a school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these bottles under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone. While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldness edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The Nakba didn't end in 1948. It continues to impact Palestinians daily. Nakba Day serves as a reminder that until there is an end to the Zionist regime's occupation, there can be no hope for peace. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Throughout Scott wrote in this regard, commenting on the recent elections. Israeli journalist Gideon Levy wrote in Haaretz that the aftermath of the elections have shown that Israeli society has become partly religious and largely racist, with hatred of Arabs being its main fuel, with no one to stand against it. While the Zionist regime continues invading Palestinian cities and killing Palestinians daily, in the United States, there is no outcry or condemnation from the Biden administration whatsoever. On the contrary, the U.S. rewards the Zionist regime with $3.8 billion in taxpayer dollars annually and demands zero accountability for its behavior in return. Congress's overwhelming silence and fear of criticizing the Israeli regime makes it complicit in the ongoing suffering of Palestinians. The U.S. has become the top enabler of Israel's systematic segregation and discrimination against the population on the basis of race. It was hardly surprising to learn that as the Zionist regime rained missiles on Gaza during Operation Shield and Arrow, Secretary of State of the United States Antony Blinken, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan rushed to proclaim their support for the Zionist regime's, as they claim, right to defend itself. Last month, U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis all visited the occupied territories of Palestine to pledge allegiance to the Zionist regime. Before them, Blinken visited the occupied territories of Palestine and reaffirmed the U.S. ironclad support for the Zionist regime, which recently voted in the most fascist, extremist, far-right government in its history. In his speech, Blinken referred to the U.S. special relationship with the Zionist regime that is rooted in shared values. Similarly, during his last visit to the occupied territories of Palestine, President Joe Biden was eager to show unshakable support for the architects of this inhumane and cruel policy of apartheid and denial of Palestinian rights. All of these actions enable the Zionist regime's crimes to go on without any recourse, punishment, or accountability. International human rights organizations, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, have issued extensive reports that included that the Zionist regime practices apartheid. United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territory, Francesca Albanese, has come under vicious attacks following her report highlighting the Zionist regime's settler colonialism and apartheid. Palestinians continue to be colonized. Palestinian lands continue to be confiscated for illegal settlement building. Palestinian family members continue to be separated from one another by walls. Palestinian communities continue to be forcibly displaced. Palestinian homes continue to be demolished. Palestinian farmers' olive trees continue to be uprooted. Palestinian children continue to be terrorized and killed by IDF. Palestinian refugees continue to be exiled. And Palestinians living inside the occupied territories continue to be discriminated against. With the complicity of its greatest ally, the U.S. regime, Israel has not only continued but has intensified its inhumane policies and violations of international law. It's hard for Palestinians to not feel helpless when they are subjected to these massive injustices for so long. But they have shown tremendous resilience and are inspired by the collective support of people in the global community and the many gains achieved by the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The magnitude of global solidarity with Palestinians shows that people, especially the younger generation, are no longer looking away. While fear and intimidation tactics by Israeli lobby groups have worked with elected officials, they have failed to gain support on the public level, especially among young Jews. Today, Palestinians have more support from people around the world than ever before, as we have seen exhibited during the FIFA World Cup and the scenes of the ever-present Palestinian flag held by supporters throughout the tournament. But while the public discourse is changing, the opposite is taking place in the Republican-controlled U.S. Congress. Recently, U.S. House Speaker McCarthy blocked Representative Rashida Tlaib from hosting an event at the Capitol commemorating the Nakba. Despite McCarthy's attempts, the event went ahead anyway, moved to a Senate office room thanks to Senator Bernie Sanders, who was able to secure a new venue in the Dirksen Senate Office Building, where McCarthy has no justification. The Nakba Day did not end in 1948. It continues to impact Palestinians everywhere daily. A Nakba Day 75 serves as an important reminder that until there is an end to the occupation, until Palestinians get justice, freedom, and equal rights, and until the Zionist regime adheres to international law, there can be no hope for peace. Also, according to Crescent International, civil rights movements dedicated to justice for Palestine have increased the tempo to isolate the Zionist regime. Support from trade unions, media commentators, political pundits, academics, and a few courageous political parties in parliament is evidence of the deep felt outrage against apartheid Israel. When and what is required to end Zionist settler colonialism are key questions as commemoration events mark 75 years of ethnic cleansing, occupation, and incremental genocide, and Nakba. Given that the heart of Palestinian resistance is located in and around Masjid al-Aqsa in occupied Al-Quds, revered by the global Muslim community as Islam's sacred citadel, liberation of Palestine remains connected to its inviolability. Armed struggle within the belly of the beast in the occupied West Bank has emerged as a focal point of resistance that not only has galvanized armed resistance in the rest of 1948 Palestine, but also inspired millions across the world. The storming of Al-Aqsa and ruthless violence against women, children, and the elderly engaged in worship during Ramadan by heavily armed Zionist troops met with a barrage of rockets fired not only from Gaza, but also from South Lebanon, Syria, to the shock and awe of the fabricated regime of Israel.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Viewpoints. I am Bita, the host of today's episode, and here with me there are two dear guest speakers, Brother Ali and Brother Hassani. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So I'm going to start the episode of today with one of the beautiful quotes from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. من أخذ للمظلوم من الظالم كان معي في الجنة مصاحبا. Whoever takes the right of the oppressed from the oppressor, whether the oppressed is a Muslim or a non-Muslim, will be with me in paradise or heaven. As you know, we see the Palestinian people that are in a condition that are oppressed. Despite this oppression, they are so powerful that we can take a lot of lessons as we talked about this point in the last episodes. And the thing and the point is that we have responsibility here towards the people who are oppressed, whether they are Muslim or non-Muslim. So in this episode, we're going to talk about these responsibilities they have, we have, and all of the parties involved here. And at first, we're going to start with the responsibilities of the Palestinian people themselves. What are their responsibilities and what they should do? So Brother Hassanein, I'm all ear for your explanation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the the responsibility, when you talk about the responsibility, the first thing that comes, the main responsibility is for Palestinians to resist.
Yeah.
So, and thankfully they have been resisting so far. So these martyrdom operations are the peak of the resistance. You see people being martyred. So the fact that a man, a youth, a boy, a girl is prepared to sacrifice his or her life for the sake of the religion and national interest is the peak of honor and bravery. So when you see this, when you resist for your country and when you resist your faith and your religion, so this fears the enemy. So when you show your resistance, this will dull the will of the enemies. So this will weaken the enemy when you fight back. So this is the first one. Like, we need this this resistance is a must. So, you know, not fearing and just fighting back.
Thank you. So, Brother Ali, do you have anything to add? Yeah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. I can define some two or three responsibilities for the people inside the Palestine or the Palestinian brothers and sisters, and then some responsibilities for the Islamic Ummah and neighboring countries from the Islamic countries. But now we are focusing on the responsibilities of the Muslims inside the Palestine. They definitely will approve me in this statement that most of them understood the uselessness of peace talks. So anything that creates division among them should be refrained from, should be avoided. Mm-hmm. So we have seen that such tricks have to be refrained and avoided anymore. I mean, they should go only for the sake of unity. And in case there are some people inside them that they are going to cause or even sow the seeds of discord, they have to actually remove them from their own societies. So because unity is the first and foremost thing that they are in need of, unity. They have to keep their unity best. Second, they have found and actually tasted the beauty of muqawama and resistance. So they have to go for it. I mean, they have to keep on their muqawama and their resistance. They understood that when they step forward, even for one single step, the other enemy, I mean, the opposite side, that is the enemy, will go back and withdraw for 10 steps, you see? And it has been seen and witnessed in reality. So it's good for them to know that muqawama is something that has a, let's say, has a fruit, has an end. They have to, I think, continue and keep and strengthen their muqawama and resistance in front of the Israeli land. Next point that I want to I understand it as, let's say, duty of the brothers and sisters in Palestine is to keep their cautiousness with the issues that they have inside them. When enemy actually finds that this unity is forming and it is going to find itself, they will definitely do some issues and among
them. Try to break it.
They will try to divide them. Yeah. They have to be cautious inside themselves to be watchful on whatever goes inside their communities and their assemblies and their events. Recently, we have seen a video that a lady was penetrating inside the Islamic communities in Palestine, and she was a famous, or let's say a professional spy of Israel. So she actually penetrated with an Arabic language, with a decent Arabic language, and then she pretended that she is, let's say, a mujahid. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, she was reporting all the activities of the Muslims to the other side. So unity, refraining from any disunity, and to take lessons from the previous peace talks, not to again get entrapped by these peace talks, by these useless peace talks, and keeping their cautiousness and be cautious on whatever is around them. And Allah's promise, inshallah, will definitely happen. Allah says, "La yansuranna Allah ma yansura, inna Allah laqawiyyun aziz." If they will do and they will care for all these steps, and Allah's promise is always in its place. I mean, we have never seen any breaking of the promise from Allah's side. If we have experienced it in our country. Whenever we were depending on ourselves, that is, we believed in our power, in our abilities and capabilities, by the help of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we progressed.
Right.
But whenever we actually put our efforts towards west or east, we have seen the result. At the time of before this revolution, King of Shah Iran, before this revolution, and also after revolution in the governments that we had, some of them actually were twisting towards west, some other toward east. And we see that the times that we were standing on our own feet, we have seen the results.
Exactly.
So we need to trust Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and to find our self-confidence. And we actually prescribe the same prescription to our Palestinian brothers and sisters.
Thank you.
Trust Allah and Allah's promise will be close.
I just would like to add like two more points to this discussion. And one already Brother Ali has mentioned that, you know, the Palestinians really need to analyze their situation over a period of time, and they need to check their past mistakes so that they can take a lesson from it and they wouldn't repeat those mistakes and would plan it better next time. And the second thing is, what I believe is one of their responsibilities is to raise their voice, virtually. Like, you know, on social media as well. You know, in a span of these few years, like 5 to 10 years, it has made a really big impact. You know, Palestinians, they're recording their videos and posting on the social media platforms. So this has made a big difference. You know, this made people, you know, come in their support. So they need to do something so their voices reach, you know, across the world. You know, everyone hears them. So, you know, so you see when on Instagram someone posts a video, you see non-Muslims commenting on that, you know, like, you know, they're criticizing Israel for oppressing them. So they need to raise their voices and they need to get active on, you know, social media to spread the conditions what are inside the Palestinians so that, you know, the world gets aware of it.
Thank you. So the point that you took into account that they have to raise their voice, they have to advertise, and they have to go into social medias and so on, I think my opinion is more related to the responsibility of Islamic Ummah more than be the responsibility of these Palestinian people. So up to here, you mentioned some responsibilities of these Palestinian people, like resistance, like unity, that are so important for sure. But as you know, we have to all have our hands together to defeat the Israel in the dark side of the story. And so in this part of the episode, I want you to talk about the responsibilities of Islamic Ummah, which I think is as important as the responsibilities of Palestinian people. Yeah. So, yeah, Brother Ali.
I want to add one more point to the earlier question.
Of course,
and then is it good to add it now or no?
No, it is okay.
I'm adding one more point to the earlier question of yours, and which I will, inshallah, repeat it in the answer to the same question that you ask it now. One of the key points that Islamic Ummah, Islamic communities, and Muslims, any duty-bound Muslim should be aware of is the power or the art of knowing who the enemy is.
Yeah.
Recognize the enemy well. This is a very great art.
Very important, yeah.
So when I said that Palestinian brothers and sisters should be cautious of what is happening inside the Palestinian ummah or Palestinian communities, so they have to recognize who is their friend and who is their enemy. This is one side. But with regard to the...
I'm sorry, brotherly, for breaking it, but unfortunately, there's still many people in the world that still do not know who is the oppressor and who are the oppressed.
Exactly. Actually, they misplaced that.
Yeah.
This is the problem. That's why I was suggesting this point.
Yeah.
And I think this is not the problem of these people. I mean, this is not a matter of cautiousness. This is the fact that the oppressor wants to be hidden.
And do you know what the reason is? Because they are actually, they have dominance over the news, news agencies. I mean, the media of the world is at the hand of
this is their power.
Zionism or Zionist-related powers, right? Yeah. So that's why. Power. Because they are working in the minds, but through media, they are working in the minds of the people.
Exactly.
So first, I suggested to the Palestinians. Second, to the Muslim Ummah. Muslim Ummah and Islamic governments have their own duty to support Palestinians, either financially or
spiritually,
or even through in the form of, let's say, equipment that they are in need of.
Yeah.
It's their duty. I mean, they cannot escape from this duty that is on our shoulders.
Yes,
this is Islamic duty that is on their shoulders.
And the least is, I feel like, verbally, you know, you show your support.
At least this is the least of things that they can do, right? But though it is not accepted, it is the least thing that they can do.
I mean, unfortunately, even that's not to be seen.
True, yeah. Sometimes, it is not being seen from the Islamic countries and Islamic governments. They are obliged, they are forced, it is their own religious duty to support Palestinians because they are oppressed.
Yeah.
And not in case they have that courage, they can even support any oppressed person in the world, whether it be it a Muslim or non-Muslim. This is their duty. Second, Palestinians, why should one side of this battle, why should one side of this fighting be fully equipped with different arms, different weapons, different models of modern weapons, but the other side should be empty of those weapons?
Yeah.
So does it bring any responsibility for the Muslim governments, Muslim countries to actually equip their brothers and sisters to at least stand to save their own lives?
Yeah.
So this is the duty to equip them with whatever they are in need of.
Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. It was all the time we had for today's episode. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Father, to wipe away my tears. That's why I will cry. I feel scared, but I won't show my fears. I keep my head high, deep in my heart. I never have any doubt. The Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
In Britain, there are signs that the National Health Service inability to offer prompt care is creating a surge in people resorting to private healthcare. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Patients are paying up to £550 an hour to see private GPs amid frustration at the delays many face getting an appointment with a National Health Service family doctor. Growing number of paid-for GP services are opening up across Britain in the latest sign of how the National Health Service inability to offer prompt care is creating a surge in people resorting to private healthcare. Clinics are wooing customers by offering short-notice consultations that involve seeing a doctor face-to-face or remotely, and they can last for much longer than the standard 10-minute NHS equivalent. Private GP services are one of the big growth areas of a burgeoning private healthcare sector, said David Hare, the chief executive of the Independent Healthcare Providers Network, a trade body. The London General Practice on Harley Street in central London had the highest fees among the 25 non-NHS GP providers that The Guardian looked at. It charges £275 for half an hour with a family doctor, £412 for 45 minutes with a family doctor, and £550 for an hour-long consultation. It rises to £348 for a 30-minute slot if it is out of hours or a bank holiday. A GP or general practitioner from the clinic will also do a house call for £500, £550 or £575, depending on the time of the day. Further along the street, synonymous with private medicine, another practice charges £220 for a half-hour appointment and £400 for the full-hour appointment. The number of patients accessing a private general practitioner GP is small compared with the 1 million a day in England who see an NHS family doctor. But it is growing fast, as the National Health Service is struggling with a deepening shortage of full-time GPs at a time when demand for care is rising and some GPs are retiring due to burnout. For example, the insurance company AXA has seen a significant spike in demand for Doctor at Hand, its virtual-only family doctor service. The number of appointments provided by Doctor at Hand had tripled from 17,000 a month before the COVID pandemic to about 50,000 today, it said. Similarly, the number of appointments provided by GPs working for Spire Healthcare The private hospital group jumped from 23,000 in 2021 to 32,900 last year, a 43% increase. People enjoy the flexibility that private GP services offer, including the ability to book longer appointments at short notice, choose the location and format of the appointment, or they want to see the same GP with each appointment, said Dr. Cathy Kale, the company's group medical director. We believe this heightened demand for private GP services is here to stay as people prioritize their healthcare and want a service that suits their needs and supports an often busy lifestyle. Spire Healthcare's acquisition last December of the Doctors Clinic Group of non-NHS GP surgeries made it one of the biggest operators in that market and increased the number of GPs it employs to 128, up from 80 in 2020. It spent £12 million on the deal because of a significant rise in patients wanting to see a GP face-to-face. Private GPs' drive to attract paying customers is helped by the fact that they can refer a patient on to the National Health Service for any follow-up care they may need, such as a scan or to see a hospital specialist. Alan Johnson, the chief executive of the London General Practice, said the quality of its service justified its high prices. "We are proud of the personalised service and high-quality care that we provide, which goes above and beyond what other healthcare providers offer, including access to 30-minute same-day appointments, a medical personal assistant available to all the patients who can arrange access to onward diagnostics or consultant appointments often for the same day, and a 24/7 visiting service. In addition, the growth in the private GP practices poses a further challenge to the National Health Service because they're likely to be staffed by those GPs who are either exhausted from working within the National Health Service or are newly qualified doctors who are dissuaded from working for the NHS because it has been so badly funded by government over the last decade. This has the potential to create a downward spiral whereby the National Health Service loses GPs, which make primary care worse, which often causes more GPs to opt out and more middle-class patients to turn to private healthcare options. Professor Martin Marshall, an ex-chair of the Royal College of GPs, voiced his fear last year that the National Health Service GP services could over time go the same way as National Health Service dentistry, with dissatisfaction with the care on offer prompting better-off patients to go private. Patient satisfaction with the National Health Service has sunk to its lowest level amid unhappiness at waiting times for GP and hospital care. Professor Camilla Hawthorne, the Royal College of GPs chair, said she did not feel particularly threatened by the expansion of private GP services. For some people, it can be a useful add-on because the clinic is easy to access on their way to work or open at the weekends. The vast majority of people would probably not go private to see a GP. They would still go to their own family doctor rather than going to private healthcare. But of course, there are people who can afford to do that and who do that, she said. The British newspaper, the Daily Mail, has also covered the same story and tells us more. Family doctors are demanding the right to charge their National Health Service patients for private appointments. It would allow wealthier patients to pay their GP to effectively jump the queue and potentially avoid the 8 a.m. scramble to be seen. But critics last night warned the two-tier healthcare system could lead to medics shunning those who cannot afford to pay, leaving them without access to healthcare. The Daily Mail reported that Some patients were paying up to £550 an hour to see a private GP amid frustration at the delays many face getting an appointment with a National Health Service family doctor. Clinics are wooing customers by offering short-notice consultations, which involve seeing a doctor face-to-face or remotely. And they can last for much longer than the standard 10-minute National Health Service equivalent. It comes after dentists slashed the number of NHS treatments and consultations they delivered in order to prioritise their more lucrative private services. Elected GP representatives yesterday passed a motion calling for the introduction of private charges at the annual conference of UK Local Medical Committees, or LMCs. The statutory body represents individual GPs and practices as a whole, and its opinion helps shape British Medical Association policy and negotiations with the National Health Service England regarding GP contracts. The motion said, conference notes that unlike dentists and pharmacists, GPs cannot currently offer many private services to their National Health Service patients, and believes that GP surgeries should, at their discretion, be allowed to offer their NHS patients paid-for healthcare services if these services are routinely offered by the National Health Service but are not accessible in a timeframe that the patient deems reasonable. Delegates also passed a motion saying general practitioners or GPs should be allowed to charge their NHS patients for services not routinely offered by the National Health Service, and that GPs should be trusted to manage potential conflicts of interest arising out of these changes. Some general practitioners, GPs, expressed concern about the policy worsening health inequalities and perpetuating a two-tier healthcare system, according to GP magazine Pulse. Dr. Jessica Randall Carrick said, "This motion perpetuates the inverse care law. Those that have the least need for our services will demand it more. And those with more diseases, the more severe disease earlier in life, will be given whatever energy we have left over." Dr. Naomi Rankin said allowing general practitioners to offer paid-for services blurs the line between National Health Service and private healthcare and encourages a two-tier healthcare system.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.